Well, good evening and welcome to the fourth lecture in the Miliband series on American power in the 21st century. And before I introduce our speaker this evening, who we're delighted to welcome, I would just like to make the announcement concerning two future lectures this term that haven't yet been advertised, just in case you want to note them. The first is by Professor Sui. Thank you. And he's going to talk on June the 9th in the Old Theatre at 6:30 and offer a Chinese perspective on the Bush Doctrine and neoconservatism. We're trying very hard this term to get away from a European and North American view and to look at American power from other regions of the world. And so I'm very pleased to have a Chinese scholar come on the 9th of October, on the 9th of June, starting on the 9th of June at 6:30. 9th of June at 6:30. And then on June the 24th in the Peacock Theatre at 6:30, sorry, back to a North American view at this time, we have John Eikenberry coming, who's a really outstanding North American IR theorist, and I hope to have him in debate with Will Hutton, who's recently written a book on the resurgence of the American Republican right, and if we can persuade Robin Cook, who should have a bit more time on his hands, to come and participate in discussion as well, it would be a very fitting close to the series this term. Well, it's a great pleasure to introduce today's title, American Power and Its Illusions, The View from Down There. And our speaker tonight is Dr. El Effendi. He's a senior research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of Westminster and coordinator of the center's project on democracy in the Muslim world. His educational background is very interesting. He's been educated at the universities of Khartoum, Wales, and Reading. It's a pretty unusual combination, it seems to me. And is the author of many books, including Tarabi's Revolution, Islam and Power in Sudan, 1991, Who Needs an Islamic State? Pretty relevant question, 1991. Revolution and Political Reform in Sudan, 1995. Rethinking Islam and Modernity, 2001. And for A State of Peace, Conflict and the Future of Democracy in Sudan, 2002. He's contributed to many leading journals, including African Affairs, Encounter, Journal of International Affairs, Futures, Muslim World, and the International Journal of Middle Eastern Studies. And he's a member of the Consultative Council of the Arab Human Rights Organization in the UK, and a trustee of the International Forum for Islamic Dialogue, and if I can get this right, and the Ibn Rushd Research Center. So please join with me to welcome him this evening for another view and a different view on American power.
Thank you, David, for inviting me, and thank you all for coming. There's a very well-known joke, a Yemeni joke, which first circulated in the 70s. Those of you who are familiar with the Arab world probably have heard it many times. And it goes like this. The two Yemenis intellectuals were sitting discussing the serious underdevelopment in that country. And one of them said, there's only one thing for it. We declared war on America. They defeat us. They came and took over the country and developed it. And the other guy said, well, this sounds like a good idea. But what happens if we defeat America? And since one gentleman of Yemeni ancestry has recently declared war on America, this doesn't look like a joke anymore. America is now very busy developing that gentleman's adopted country, Afghanistan, and now paying attention to many others, which seems to have served the original purpose. On the other hand, the America which is engaged in this reluctant benevolence doesn't seem to be like a winner either. So the gentleman has probably got the worst or best of both worlds, however you look at it. For one thing, the rising consensus, if we believe it, among most commentators, that September 11th has changed everything and dictated the agenda for the United States and for the world, for that matter, for the next 50 years, showed that probably the terrorists have achieved a victory of sorts in this confrontation. We might soon start to call this Osama's century. This makes the fact that the terrorists has gained their original and stated goal of getting the American troops out of the of Saudi Arabia seems like a small footnote. But more interestingly, if we listen to the rhetoric coming out of Washington these days, we might be excused to think that Osama is already in charge over there. The professions of piety and religious enthusiasm coming from the mother of all empires is so intensive as to make the hermits of Afghanistan feel green with envy. For one commentator, at least.
Can I stop you just a second? I want to make sure people can hear, because they're signaling that they can't. It's difficult to hear. Can we try this mic? You can hear me, can't you?
Yeah.
Do you want to just? Do you mind? Because we don't want to miss what you're saying. And I was beginning to see people look puzzled. So let's. I'll get away from you a bit. Okay. And feel more relaxed.
All right.
Let's just. Yeah.
Am I being heard now?
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
Okay, I'll start.
Start again.
No. No. Well, I just go back to the last point, which I think the professions of piety, as I said, coming from Washington, are so intensive as to make the hermits in the caves of Afghanistan feel green with envy. For one commentator, at least, these bursts of religious enthusiasm are actually a reassuring sign. They should be seen, for example, as this commentator said, the use of explicitly theological language in President George W. Bush's recent State of the Union address last January should be taken to signal that actually all these claims about American imperial ambitions should be dismissed. They are unfounded. Are unfounded as I mean, my comment that the America is as innocent of imperial ambition as Caesar was of secretly harboring royal aspirations. The quotes from George Bush, which have this theological overtone, are first, the liberty we prize is not America's gift to the world. It is God's gift to humanity. And this, according to this commentator, means that America does not want to impose its values. Bush also says, we exercise power without conquest and sacrifice for the liberty of strangers because this is the right thing to do. Now, for this particular commentator, and I quote, America acts on behalf of freedom not because it is benevolent, though it often is, nor because it wields its power prudently, though it often does, but because defending freedom is the right thing to do. God created people for freedom. America and all other nations are called by divine mandate to recognize this freedom. It is a justice instituted by God. So when we fight on God's side. For those who might see in this reassurance a more frightening prospect than the threat it tries to dispel, the commentator quotes more theological remarks by the president. We do not claim to know all, I quote, we do not claim to know all the ways of providence. Bush has said, yet we can trust in them, placing our confidence in the loving God behind all of life and history. And the implication is, and I quote again from the commentator, that any divine favor America possesses is the result not of its intrinsic merit, but of God's gift. Such a gift may be taken from us. Scripture teaches us that nations rise and fall by God's command. To be a nation under God is to be, among other things, under his judgment, to be held accountable to his standards of justice. Liberty for America is not a divine birthright, but a divine challenge, so we strive to be just. End of quote. Now, for some of us who may not be satisfied with this theological invocation of God, there is another version of America's status as an empire of virtue. It's a secular one, and I'll quote from also one of the proponents of this view. The 21st century imperium is a new invention in the annals of political science. An empire light, a global hegemony whose grace notes are free markets, human rights, and democracy, enforced by the most awesome military power the world has ever known. It is the imperialism of a people who remember that their country secured its independence by revolt against an empire, and who like to think themselves as the friends of freedom everywhere. Now, many of you might say that an empire which is the friend of freedom is a contradictory in terms, just as revelations coming from Washington instead of Jerusalem is also a novelty. For some people, of course, try to qualify this a little bit by saying that America is an empire with a difference, or an empire by invitation, which relies more on soft power, of which I speak a little bit later, than outright military subjugation. In other words, it's an empire that's not really an empire. For one of these enthusiasts also, that in spite of the critics of America, we have to recognize that it remains a fact, as disagreeable to those left-wingers who regard American imperialism at the root of all evil, as it is to the right-wing isolationists who believe that the world beyond our shores is none of our business, that there are many people who owe their freedom to an exercise of American military power. Now, far-fetched as these claims may seem, they apparently seem to find vindication in America's most recent conquest on the banks of the Tigris. In Iraq, America has shown itself simultaneously as an instrument of divine providence and also as an empire which liberates its conquest. It's not only from the perspective of those people in Asheville, North Carolina, and other places who think that what happened is, quote, God's plan to battle the spirit of Babylon, that this could be seen as a divine providence in action. In Qom and Karbala also, there is a perspective which could see this as divine action, as a karama of the late Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who would be very pleased to see the great Satan doing, to quote an older and forgotten George Bush, God's work. Iran, as we know, the Islamic Republic of Iran, had spent the turbulent quarter of a century or so of its life battling mainly against the evil dictatorship of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Iran has also almost went to blows against the heretical Taliban regime in Afghanistan in 1998. Of the internal enemies of Tehran, the worst, of course, are the People's Warriors or Mujahideen Khalq, whose lethal cocktail of Islamism, Marxism, and charismatic leadership inspired dedication and fanaticism that came close to matching that of the Islamic Republic itself. For nearly 16 years, these people have been lodged in Iraq. But in his last will and testament, Ayatollah Khomeini reserved most of his venom for the Wahhabi rulers of Saudi Arabia, urging his successors not to tire from battling them and to curse them publicly all the time. Now, by divine grace, God's other soldiers have dispatched the heretical Taliban and brought down the evil Saddam Hussein without squaring the faithful to lift so much as a finger. And if the new imperial rhetoric emanating from Washington to be believed, the Saudi tyranny will be history before you can say the Ayatollah is a divinely inspired saint. And as for the Mujahideen, it was a sight to see the American planes bombing them instead of God's other soldiers. Now, from... Okay. Yes, okay. Well, you asked the audience. So there is more perspective from which one can see that people could see America as doing the work of divine providence. They are, if you are the Ayatollah. There is, of course, no accounting to the mysterious ways of the Lord. But it is safe to assume that the revolution his faithful servants on the Potomac had hoped to export to Najaf in their latest foray of frontier management was not Ayatollah Khomeini's favorite one, but the other revolution, the one which Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln and Woodrow Wilson were so particular about. But there has been some success also on this regard. The scenes of jubilation which we saw from Baghdad and the celebration of freedom by the Iraqis certainly indicate that this was a welcome kind of event. So the question arises now, if America has been doing in this latest conquest good for God and man, why does everybody seem to be so unenthusiastic? Why are the Ayatollahs not jumping for joy and home? And why are the peace campaigners and freedom lovers the world over are on the barricades on the other sides? It's certainly a puzzling question. If for someone to become the villain in a plot where Saddam Hussein is the hero, takes a lot of work. But it's not as this is not as mysterious as it seems. One explanation can be found in the commodity which is being exported and how it has been packaged. There is no denying that the American Revolution is a very eminently exportable commodity. American Revolution, as Hannah Arendt has said, is probably the most successful political revolution in the world, and I could add it's probably the only successful political revolution in the world. It has achieved this success through adopting implicitly a couple of Marxist maxims. One of them is the Maoist principle of continuous revolution. American Revolution can be seen in this regard as a series of revolution, actually, starting with the original war of liberation, going on to the Civil War and the end of slavery. And this first, the Civil War indicates the direction in which this revolution was moving, trying to do what I call equalizing the value of human labor. Because if we see slavery as an instance where the value of human labor is reduced to zero, the ending of slavery is not only actualizing the principle of equality of man, but also a step towards equalizing the value of human labor. Now, this is the second principle, I think, of the American Revolution, trying to make equality concrete. We could speak of other American revolutions like the Civil Rights Movement and before that the New Deal, which all tended to move in the same direction. Now, what is happening now is that we are witnessing, or we have starting to witness since the Reagan era, one of the rare counter-revolutions inside the American Revolution. And that's why it's being exported at a time when there is a slump in demand for it at home. There are two things about the Reaganite Revolution, which is now being also revived by George W. Bush. The first thing is that it tries to go back on the Civil Rights, New Deal, not to say, I'm not going to say on the end of slavery, but on many other things. When on the eve of the recent campaign in Iraq, both Tony Blair and President Bush were at pains to explain that the action in Iraq was a part of a greater plan, which is seeking to spread freedom, equality at home and abroad. But of course, observers could not fail to notice that at that time we had here the firemen's dispute, and we have been hearing in Washington not only the old Reaganite recipes of tax cuts, but the appointment of racist judges to the bench, and the resurgence of racist remarks by leading congressmen, which was only the tip of the iceberg. Part of this counter-revolution has been absorbed into the policy known as the Third Way. Are we still in Third Way territory, or is it safe to speak? The Third Way is also an attempt to try to reconcile itself with the Thatcherite. Now, the other aspect about the Reaganite Revolution is that it was not unconnected to the Middle East. It came 1 year after the Iranian Revolution, and the Iranian revolutionaries did have a hand in it, because by the way they humiliated Carter, they had helped the Reagan campaign. But this is not the only aspect which seems to have this dynamic relation between the Middle East and what's happening in Washington. On the eve of the campaign, the current campaign in Iraq, enthusiastic critics alike agreed that it was indeed the mother of all battles, which will not only reshape the destiny of the Middle East, but also that of America and the world as a whole. The creation of the new world is going to begin in the Middle East. Now, this was not the first time events in the Middle East has shaped empires either in the West or in the East and determined their fate. I mean, we know about Suez. And there is an argument that the end of the first phase of American expansionism in the 1970s was not actually Vietnam, but Iran, not Vietnam 1975, but Iran 1979. We know, of course, that there's also a strong argument that the Soviet Empire had met its Waterloo in Afghanistan. Now, all these campaigns, all these interactions between the Middle East and America are part of a number of patterns. There is a general pattern which relates to empires as a whole. According to one commentator, the principal preoccupation of guardians of empire is the frontier, what the Romans called the lines. The frontier separates insiders and outsiders, citizens and subjects, within from barbarians without. This does not mean that the barbarians cannot enter the empire. They can and they do. They are often actively recruited as professional soldiers in Roman days, as industrial workers, as gardeners, as house cleaners, as hospital orderlies, and also skilled professionals. But the empire seeks to control their flow from the frontier of antiquity to the fences along the Mexican border. For one empire, which is the model for the new one, Rome, an inversion happened and the frontier came inside. The barbarians took over culturally with Christianity and later militarily with their occupation. The Holy Roman Empire at that time became not only a caricature of the old Roman Empire, but the embodiment of this defeat from within. It is one victory the barbarians from our side has come to regret. Our area in the Middle East has a history of exporting religious doctrines to these parts of the world with mounting success. Unlike other things we export to the West, we tend to get our goods back a short while later, hardly recognizable and 10 times as expensive. The last time we looked, the teachings of our man from Nazareth included advice such as love thy enemy and turn the other cheek. But this is not the echo we have been receiving back over the past 1,000 years. The scriptures are nowadays delivered to our doors wrapped in depleted uranium. Now, the Middle East has always also been a frontier of fascination for Western empires, from Alexandria, Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, Napoleon, Allenby, Cromer. And this fascination had a mystique about it. It's kind of, they found the Middle East is not like other empires. When you go there, it's not like going to South America and other places, without meaning to be dismissive of any other place of the world, but that's history. There is actually another argument that the Cold War may not have been won and lost in Kabul, because the Muslim world as a whole has been for a long time the battleground, the major battleground of the Cold War. And the Soviet Empire has received its early setbacks in that region long before Afghanistan. There was Malaysia, 1950s, Indonesia, 1960s, Egypt and Somalia, 1970s, and not to mention, of course, Iran. The War of Lebanon in 1982 was probably one of the greatest defeats for the Soviet Union, because the weapons they have been supplying to the Syrians were decimated, were no match to the weapons which America has supplied to their opponents. Now, this raises the other question, that the Western and American forays in the Middle East have also been accused of the other thing, of fomenting religious revivalism there and radicalism. And this is not only directly through the funding and supporting of the Afghan Mujahideen and other anti-communist groups. Other adventures in the Middle East, for example, the creation of Israel was a very interesting episode in the religious revival in the Middle East. Not only because the resistance to Israel had galvanized and mobilized some people along the religious line, but for the very fact that Israel also offered an example of religious revivalism. The secular forces in the Middle East have been for decades battling and trying to say modernization means secularization. You have to leave religion behind in order to go forward. And then suddenly, a religious state comes and becomes so successful that it defeats everybody, all the secular regimes of the region. So the argument is buried in the rubble. Now, the relations thus of the American empire to the Middle East, the way the dynamism seems to be going forth and back, manifests itself in this paradox which I started. The paradox that the conquest of Iraq doesn't seem like much of a victory if you look at what the celebration in Najaf and Karbala, that their death to America was one of the shouts, not to mention the other religious fervor. So you are releasing forces which you actually would rather have let sleep. But more importantly and more directly, American power in the Middle East manifests itself as plain and pure, as powerless, pure and simple. You could bomb Yasser Arafat into a corner of his office, but you could not get him to sign any paper, let alone deliver what he signs on. Of course, we know that bombing Sharon is not on the cards, but also the way that a superpower with all this weapon is reduced to pleading with its clients is a sign of utter powerlessness. You can do nothing without, you cannot get your clients to do anything. You cannot even get Saudi Arabia. You cannot get even Kuwait to give women the right to vote. You cannot get Egypt to stop harassing American citizens who are democracy activists. So there are two sides to this, to American involvement in Middle East. All of them show actually that probably the Middle East is shaping America more than America is shaping the Middle East. That we get the echo of Osama bin Laden from Washington rather than getting the echo of George Bush from Iraq. For some commentators, this might be just a manifestation of the limits of American power, and at least the limit of its benevolent side. Some of these critics say that America is neither wholeheartedly supportive of democracy, nor should it be, because there are limits to what you could do with your power. What complicates things further is that part of the involvement in the Middle East, which culminated in the current campaign on terrorism, or the so-called war on terrorism, which is significant that it's not a war on terrorists, but war on terrorism. But this war has been wrapped into rhetoric of identity politics. As I mentioned earlier, Iraq was sold as the mother of all battles. That we have to do this or we're finished. Our identity, our values are a threat. And of course, the culmination is the issue of so-called clash of civilization. Even those who do not subscribe to this thesis publicly use the rhetoric of us against them. Let us set aside that the war on terrorism doesn't seem to have any relation to terrorism. The terrorists did not come from rogue states. They came from states which seemed friendly to the United States and pillars of stability. They did not use weapons of mass destruction. They did not use actually any weapons at all, except for box cutters. So the hunt for weapons of mass destruction and rogue states seems to be a diversion from actually the real battle. Not to mention, as I said, creating more threats in the process. But this is not the issue what I'm concerned with here. The issue is that the way the rhetoric surrounding the campaign and the implicit assumption driving it that the threat of terrorism comes specifically from Muslims angered by U.S. policies toward the region feeds the perception on both sides of the divide that this is indeed a campaign against Islam as a religion and a culture. The total reliance on hard power vis-a-vis the Middle East in contrast with other areas such as North Korea is premised on deeply held assumptions about the region and its peoples, which we need not go into details here, but it seems to be, in short, that the folks down there are somewhat immune to seduction by American soft power and only understand communications emanating from the barrel of a gun. There is an irreducible gap of misunderstanding marked by a civilizational fault line that could not be bridged. So you have to subjugate them, the barbarians, because the barbarians you cannot talk to. Soft power, as discussed by Nye and others, I mean, it's part of the innocence of American political science, is that Joseph Nye speaks about soft power with reference to Gramsci without any irony in this. Totally neglecting that Gramsci, when he used the term hegemony in this sense, he meant to use it not in the way he wanted, Nye wanted to use it as an attractive seduction, but as pervert kind of manipulation, which is insidious and should be combated. But that's another point. For one perceptive commentator, the point of clash of civilization is actually a cover for all themes, which the central theme in which is white suprematist power. When people, he said, Horn said, speak about clash of civilization, they mean white people against non-white people. There is actually a support for this in the experience of American blacks. American black citizens are, of course, the most American of all human beings apart from America, because they have no culture other than American culture. They could not be said to be from another culture, from another civilization. But they have been treated continuously worse than many other immigrants who come from other cultures and civilizations. But this is the one paradox of empire, of course, regarding to this divide, is that yes, the recent attempts to expand the American empire have tended to create some kind of what we call virtual empire. Empires do have responsibilities to their citizens. Expanding the Roman Empire or any other empire means bringing people in. Some of these people, especially the elites, are co-opted into the hierarchy. Empire, in its logic, would end becoming a republic. If America annexed Texas, the Texans would eventually be American citizens. If America wanted to annex Iraq, Iraqi citizens would have a voice in how America is run. But the virtual empire in one which uses zero responsibility, accepts zero responsibility. But at the same time, the logic of this empire means, given that, given the rhetoric of political zealousness, religious zealotry, and cultural political imperialism, ends in drawing line of demarcation that in turn became the basis of new distributive policy. In the absence of a Marxian utopia, where limitless resources combined with universal benevolence to create heaven on earth, empires will have to preside over coercive redistribution of resources for the benefit of insiders at the expense of those considered outsiders. In this regard, the debate on whether this is a war on Islam and the reassurances offered that this is not the case are a matter of irrelevance. Most Muslims do not care if Bush and Blair respect Islam or hated it, and they shouldn't either, because attitude towards the religion is a matter of free choice. You are not required to love Islam or hate it. What is worrying, the most determined enemies of Islam as a religion are some people whose names like Islam Karimov and Ali and Saddam and people come from the Muslim world. In fact, there is a sense in which America, in this regard, is fighting on God's side, in that Muslims who are under American domination or who are in America are getting more religious freedom than some who are in other places. But that's not the issue. And this means also that all this talk of dialogue across civilization and religion is also pointless unless it is tied to some concrete action. What is problematic for people who are at the receiving end of some of the American Empire or its clients is not the fact that they think there is religious victimization. It is the fact that there is deprivation, their homes are being taken or repossessed, they are under undemocratic governments allied to America, and some other very concrete events. Now, I'm going to end with a small anecdote, which goes back to another imperial age in pre-Islamic Arabia. This story, which is reputed to have taken place in Mecca on the year the Prophet Muhammad was born, related to a campaign by the Ethiopian Abyssinian at that time, governor of Yemen, who wanted to attack Mecca and destroy the Kaaba, or the holy house of God there, said to be built by Abraham. That was called the Year of the Elephant because that army which came was led by elephant riders. And the story goes that when Abraha, who was the general, arrived at Mecca, the people were so terrified of his army that they all fled. They didn't want to fight. So he sent around and he said, I would like to see the leader of this community to speak to him. And the leader at that time was the grandfather of the Prophet, known as his name is Abdul Muttalib. So he was brought in his presence, and he chatted with him. He liked him very much. The guy was a young, handsome man, very articulate. And he said to him, I like you very much. You can ask me anything you want. And the man said to him, "Your soldiers have rustled 200 of my camels. I want them back." And he said to him, "I am really disappointed in you. I have come here to destroy the holy house of your holy house and that of your ancestors and your God. And all you are asking me is about your camels." And the man said, "Well, I am the owner of these camels. That house had an owner who can look after it." So he gave him his camels and sent him away. The rest of the story, of course, is that the man could not destroy the house because some acts of God did decimate his army. And the moral of the story is, it's not, Muslims should not be worried too much about the rhetoric about war in Islam. It is the camels we are worried about. Thank you very much.
Well, we usually take questions in clusters of two or three, and I would like to have as much of a dialogue as we can in the last 20 minutes, half an hour. So let me just start by asking a question, then we'll take a few more. If I understood you correctly, you portrayed quite a sort of bleak view of the coalition intentions, of the nature of American power. You've talked about it's not just a war against terrorists, but against terrorism. It's a war without responsibility, and a war in which the premise is that Islam can't be engaged with by soft power, and therefore somehow needs to be restricted and contained by hard power. But I have two questions, really. What do you think drives this American foreign policy now in the Middle East? Why is it the Americans at this time have come to the view that foreign policy in the Middle East needs to be reshaped in such a radical way? And secondly, what do you think they think is the outcome of all of this? Because from what you've suggested, it seems to me, that the Middle East is the rock on which many grand designs have founded. But it looks to me as if Iraq is the foothold that may well disentangle traditional Middle Eastern politics. So let me just come back to two questions. What is the driving rationale, do you think, of American foreign policy in the Middle East now? And what do you think are the outcomes that are sought? Let's leave it at that, and let me just ask others to this day. Okay.
Well, I think the general wisdom is that this new conservative agenda of the so-called unilateralist, which is driving American foreign policy at the moment, and this group is described by, I think, Joseph Nye as people who are without brakes, who think that American power is so formidable, is so miraculous that it can do anything, and you don't need to talk to people, you don't even need to talk to Europeans or anybody else, you can do whatever you like. This is, I think, one theme which there is some logic to it. But I think the other aspect of it is, as I said, it is Middle East driven. In the Middle East, there is a vacuum. This vacuum has come from the stalemate which has held there for years between Israel and the Arabs. On this stalemate, the Arabs seem to be the poorer, the weaker party, and they are. But I think the misperception here is that American policymakers have mistaken the weakness of the states to the weakness of the people. The weakness of the state, I think, is the cause of much of the problems of the Middle East, including terrorism. Vigilante terrorism is the outcome of the collapse of the state, and the state has become out of play. I mean, if, for example, nowadays in Iraq, people who don't like the American troops there go and demonstrate or form parties. But if you are a Saudi, You don't have those options. You cannot go and have a demonstration against American forces in Saudi Arabia. You cannot form a political party or a civil society group to protest against this. So in the end, you are driven to some act of violence. In Palestine, I think that the states also have tended to, because they realize their weakness, to contract out violence. I mean, states are supposed to be the monopolizers of violence, but in the Middle East, the states, since the outbreak of the Palestinian revolution in 1965, it was not actually a revolution. It was a state engineered private armies. And nowadays we see this in Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Lebanese state with the Syrian state, they contract out because the nature now of the state, of the weakness of the state, of the necessitate this kind, you cannot as a state go and fight Israel. So what you do, you get somebody else to do it who doesn't have a responsibility and who cannot be bombed like you. This is one thing. So I think the mistake of the American policymakers is not to understand this dimension, that weakening the states more, hitting Iraq, taking Saddam Hussein off is not going to end the problem, because the problem is going to come out actually even more. You have to go to the root cause of the instability and solve it. Then you can have a constructive dialogue with the people of the region.
But is the root instability the Middle Eastern conflict, in terms of the conflict between Israel and its neighbors, and or is the root the despotisms of the Middle Eastern states, the lack of democracy, the lack of respect for, let's say, international human rights and so on? I mean, you can cut this root up in different ways. So, I mean, you seem to be arguing the root is the Israel-Palestine question.
I think from America's perspective, the root is the Israeli-Arab conflict, because, for example, Saudi Arabia and the Saudi people don't have any grudge, particular grudge against America. Actually, they love America. They love American goods. And one of the interesting things, for example, there is a famous food company in Saudi Arabia called Americana. They used to call it Americana because everybody loved American goods. Now, most recently, of course, all Arabs began to hate America. So this company, when it makes its advertisement television, it says, Americana, 100% Arab, to distance itself from America. I think the America has problems in Saudi Arabia because of its perceived role of supporting Israel. Otherwise, it could have had a very friendly relationship with Arab countries constructively. This from the perspective of America. I think from the perspective of the people, yes, I think the lack of democracy is the main thing, because that's for most of them. I mean, people in Saudi Arabia, for example, are far away from Palestine, but they suffer. People from in Iraq also were far away from Palestine, but they suffered under despotism. So despotism is part of the problem, but I think the way the international community has dealt with despotism also in the region was supportive of it.
What's the?
Was supportive of despotism.
Yeah. Okay, so let me, oh, look at this, excellent. 4-5, well, let's just take 4-5, if that's all right with our speaker. Yeah, we'll just go around.
Thank you very much. What it seems the two interventions America made, Afghanistan and Iraq, is that the international community does get involved, that though the rhetoric of United States policymakers against the United Nations, I understand now, well, since the fall of the Taliban, there's been various groups in Afghanistan. There was initially a British peacekeeping force, then a Turkish, and I think now you've got a German and Dutch force. And I think in Iraq, I read that they're dividing it up into three zones, the American, the British, and the Polish. I understand the Polish forces contributed to the coalition, and maybe they're asking for other countries to contribute peacekeeping forces. So this American intervention seems, despite the rhetoric, a catalyst for international community to provide international forces, a bit like Bosnia and Kosovo. Could you comment on that?
But not yet. Let's go around. just call this, yeah.
You said rather than the US shaping the Middle East is shaping the US. So how can you, could you please demonstrate how the Middle East is actually shaping the US? And you don't think the US, you think that the US is powerless in the Middle East to do anything, but I don't know that it has definitely tried to use its influence on the dictatorships present in the Middle East to shape up and introduce democracy. Syria, after all, is shutting down the offices of Hamas and others because of US pressure, so that would seem to demonstrate otherwise. And I'm curious about your comments that of modernization, secularization, are being disproved for the Arab states because of the progress of Israel. Well, Israel, though theoretically, yes, it was set up for religious reasons, but it has acted as a secular state, so its modernization is more due to the secularization rather than the power of the religious extremes, I would have thought.
Down here? Yeah.
Sorry, is it possible to first listen to the answers?
No.
Of those? Because
it's a dictatorship.
Just remember all the... what I wanted to say is that do you think that Americans want to come and solve the problems in the Middle East, or they have something for themselves? They, if that is the case, why should their soldiers come and fight there to solve the problem of Middle East without the intention which they have for themselves? I think that Americans and maybe as a big power, they didn't want and they still don't want democracies in the Middle East. Otherwise, they could put Saudi Arabia under pressure and some other countries to spread democracies there. But they wanted to remove the dangers that they think would pose from states like you know, Saddam Hussein, which would support the terrorists, which would create more dangers for the United States. And one more point that you said before, that secularism was dismissed or defeated by an Islamic revolution in Iran. I just wanted to say that if you go back to Iran now, after nearly 25 years of that revolution, the majority of people just don't want to see this Islamic State, and they would shake hands with Americans to come and help them to remove this. I just came last week from Iran, and maybe I couldn't find even 1% of the people in the street to support this government. So, you know, the Americans don't go there to solve the problems. Maybe they just want to remove these kind of regimes that would cause danger for them. Thank you.
Okay, one more question.
It seems fairly clear that you're not very keen on American imperialism. That was fairly obvious from your talk, in spite of your sense of irony. But what about the idea of American isolationism? If you know anything about American history, you'll know that they've been isolationists for much longer than they've been imperialists. And suppose America suddenly, conduct a thought experiment, it got overtaken by a burst of isolationism, and it really did withdraw, bring the boys back home and let the world go hang. And suppose as part of that, it withdrew all its moral, political, and financial support from its three major client states in the region, namely Israel, Egypt, and Turkey. What would be the consequences of that?
Fifth question? The reason for having a roll of questions is that we get a sense of what the audience thinks as well as what the speaker thinks. And a fifth question? Yeah, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Abdulwahab Al-Afendi. I was telling a friend before the lecture, I said to him, Abdulwahab Al-Afendi was invited to lecture in the University of Yale in the early 1990s, I think it was 1993. And LSE across the road invited him 10 years later. And that seems to demonstrate the theory of shaving starting from down there. But what I wanted to ask Al-Afendi about is, where is this patriotism and call for unity of of nationalism in the United States leading to, and because I'm concerned about the thin line between nationalism and hatred. We read in history that Hitler was saying, we were not, or we are not, or we do not wish to have a God, only Germany. And at that time, this meant discriminating against the Jews at that time in Germany and Europe. And that was a reflection of, because this a notion, of course, Hitler was the most extreme example, but the notion of call for unity within Germany, and what people who do not support this unity in Germany were called and were treated like. And the Jews, of course, the people who suffered much at that time. And I'm just concerned about this, and if this thin line could be made more thicker to see the divide between the, or the dividing line between these two concepts of hatred and call for unity and nationalism.
Between which two concepts, nationalism and?
Hatred.
Thank you. So that's five questions for you. The first about the rationale of the coalition forces and territorial division. The second about how the Middle East, in fact, shapes the U.S. if it does. The third is about what is in it for the USA. I mean, the fourth is, would isolationism be more preferable in a thought experiment than the current American position? And then the fifth we've just heard is between the question about the relationship between nationalism and hatred. Whose nationalism and hatred, one might ask?
I think there was the first question about the UN and the...
Yes.
There was a first point about the UN and the role of multinational forces in Africa. I think the ideally, of course, any country should be able to govern itself and govern itself through some understanding between its component parts. Now, the role of outsiders is to try to guide it towards that direction. I think it's quite a good thing that there's some people who are trying to help Afghanistan and Iraq. In Afghanistan, they seem to be doing too little. Too slowly, and still doesn't seem to have moved. There's a half-heartedness about it. In Iraq, we have to wait and see. I think in Iraq, probably Iraq is much easier to handle, and the intentions expressed up to now are the right ones, that they want to help the Iraqis govern themselves and then leave. So we have to wait and see how this is going to help. This will link me, I think, to two questions of the intentions and of the isolationism, which I think are related. The intentions, nobody in the U.S. Administration is hiding the fact that they were in Iraq for American interests. Actually, George W. Bush was quite clear in selling this to the people as, there's imminent, clear, and present danger for us there. And then we will help the people in the bargain. Now, I think one of the themes I have tried to explicate is that there is a strong trend from Wilson upwards in America of people who see the identity of the national interests of America with spreading democracy abroad. So, in spite of the fact that there may be people who are whom Joseph Nye called the unilateralist, and I call, I think the people who are now at the forefront of American policy Donald Rumsfeld and others at this moment, I would probably call the isolationist interventionists. In that, for short, you could call them imperialists, in the sense that they want to engage with the outside world. They are not isolationists. They want to shape the outside world, but they want to shape it without talking to it or bothering with it at the end of a gun. The question is whether isolationism is preferable. I think isolationism for America is impossible anyway. It's so much powerful, it influences people even without doing anything. The question is how to manage it, how to manage your influence abroad. Now, as I said, imperialism, if it's pursued wholeheartedly, will end up including other people into the American fold, which I don't think any American policymaker at the moment wants to do. What is worrisome is what I call empire without responsibility or virtual empire, where you intervene, but you don't take responsibility for what you do. The most glaring example of this was the sanctions against Iraq. Now, I'm one person who said from the beginning that war is preferable to sanctions, because sanctions are an act of irresponsibility. You shift the responsibility for the people, for the innocent people on Saddam Hussein, whom you know doesn't care about the people. This means that you also don't care about the people. So in this fact, if we have a choice with imperialism as a responsibility or virtual imperialism, I would prefer imperialism, pure and simple, because then you take responsibility for your action. You go and invade Iraq, you run it. You provide for the people food, you provide for them shelter, you help them. But not sitting in London and say, well, you can't eat, you can't do this, and I don't care. The question about Middle East affecting the US, I think, is clear, for example, that since September 11th, American policymakers are doing nothing else but reacting to the Middle East and interacting with the Middle East. The politics of the Middle East became home. I mean, people in America who don't know their, their Des Moines from their Montana now know their Basra from their Nasiriya, and they know about the Shia and the Ashire and everything. You watch American television, you are in Iraq. You are not in America anymore. So it is influencing. It's influencing too much, and the agenda is being set around what's happening in the Middle East. So the influence is there and it's very palpable. The powerlessness also is quite there. I mean, yes, you can get Syria to close the offices of Hamas, but you needed Syria before that to contain Iraq, and you needed Kuwait to contain. So you have to juggle your things. You cannot. You need Saudi Arabia to wake Iraq or to wake Iran. You need Iran to wake Saudi Arabia. So you are in. I think America has got now enmeshed into this quagmire of kind of trying to juggle things, because also, although the Bush administration has been more interventionist and forceful than others, it also knows that there is a limit to what you can do. They cannot go to war tomorrow against Iran and day after tomorrow against Saudi Arabia, because apart from the cost, it's just the American people have no patience for these endless campaigns. So you have to really cut and run as quickly as you can before you get involved in another civil war in Iraq and become also in other problems. The question of Israel and modernism, which are two related ones, I don't dispute with you what's happening in Iran. I think, yes, Islamism in Iran had surged, now it's at an ebb. The Israel question, it is true that Israel is a secular country, but if you compare it to Turkey, which, for example, does fight against or Tunis, which restricts religious freedom for personal freedom, and you compare Israel, which endows religious schools and supports religious activities, and some of the most important supporters of Islamic revivalism in the 1960s, prominent among them was a guy called Muhammad Jalal Kishk, an Egyptian writer, have consistently harped on this against the secularists. They were saying to them, look, for example, some of the secularists were saying, well, let us change the Arabic language and use a colloquial. And he says, you people, look at the Jews next door. They have come and revived a language which has been dead for 2,000 years and a religion which has not been here, and now they are thriving and they're better than us. And you want us to destroy our language and our religion and this and this. So it was used in this regard. Nationalism now. And I did actually warn about this rhetoric, I think, of identity with the war on terrorism, because there's been a very dangerous mix in this regard. Everybody's agreed that there should be no tolerance of terrorism, and that there should be an international consensus on fighting terrorism. Now, if you go along that, if you go with that into multilateral way, that would probably get us somewhere. But if you try to say, well, you use a language which suggests, for example, that Muslims are terrorists, or that you pass laws, for example, either here or in America, which, for example, requires a citizen from Muslim countries to register and or arrest them on suspicion because you think that they are the terrorists, you seem to be acting with a frame of mind which says, well, which is true in a sense, that at the moment, the people who are aggrieved mostly at the US policies are Muslims, happen to be Muslims. So it is safe bet to say that most of the terrorists are going to be from those parts of the world. But putting the horse before the cart is a problem here, that you are not going to have a dialogue to reduce, for example, and limit the number of those aggrieved people so that you can contain the rest and have a more safe kind of environment and more help from other people in this regard. So using the logic of identity, I think, in this, and the rhetoric of identity is dangerous.
A few more very short questions, and then,
you have given a very good aperçu on the whole thing, but I would like your opinion on my comment. There are three different opinions in the area. One of the governments who are pro-conflict, pro-US helping. You have the business and banking area who want either way, war, no war, let's go back to business because cash are drying up and so on. And you have the population who take any excuse to use their voice against the lack of freedom to complain about their own government. Not having this possibility to complain about their government, they use any excuse to go in the street. Islam in that area, from the Gulf to the whole of Middle East, Islam is not a question, is not in question.
Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Lafandi, there is a rife opinion in the Arab world, from Sudan up to Iraq, that seem to express its opinion in eschatological agenda, that the American triumphalism, if it is irreversible, But it's now the fact that Iraq is being occupied is in fact, I think, a scenario to help Israel to achieve its Biblic agenda by occupying Euphrates. And the rest of the agenda is that Israeli Grand or Grand Israel will be expanding up to the Nile. So do you think this idea is legitimate or too far reached? And do you think if it is legitimate, it will really propel the Muslims to forge new alliances to repel what they could see in the Arab world as an American-Israeli occupation of Iraq rather than liberating of Iraq? Second question emanating from this is that now 600 oil wells in Iraq has been occupied as well, according to observers. So given the fact that China has got tremendous suspicions about its oil resources, and America is seeing to it that these resources should be cut, do you think that what Samuel Huntington depicted as clash of civilization would propel or trigger or set in a sort of an alliance between Islam, Islamic world, and Confucianism, or an Islam or Confucian alliance is already being set forth? Thank you.
Brief?
Yeah. Now, the Americans think that democracy is the best system in human history. And they want to export democracy like the way they export McDonald's. Now, instead of democracy being chosen by Iraqi people, they use military force to change the regime and give democracy to the American people. By common sense, we look at it this way. Now, can you tell us, how do you see it from an Islamic point of view? Thank you.
A final question? Yeah.
Just one question is, how compatible or incompatible can become the two models, the Anglo-Saxon USA-UK model toward the Middle East and the French, Russian, German model in the near future, actually? And how compatible or incompatible will it be with the United Nations institutional framework?
Compatible with what?
United Nations need to play a predominant role in the future development of the region, and particularly with Iraq, but probably UK and USA are a little bit reluctant.
Let me just ask you one final reflection. I mean, I have been very critical of the coalition campaign. I don't believe that the war against Iraq was a legitimate or legal war, and I believe there were firmly alternatives within the framework of international law and multilateral institutions. But leaving that aside, couldn't you say that what, I mean, I've read a lot of the rhetoric and speeches of the American Republican right in the last 10 years. And one of the things that strikes me, the theme that comes over and over again, explaining intentions and objectives, is that there's a general view that the Middle East was untouched by 1989. I mean, the end of the Cold War brought a wave of democratization and marketization, as it were, around the world, but left the Middle East more or less intact, proposition one. Proposition two, that the Middle East remains one of the most dangerous sources of stability and instability and conflict in the world. And therefore, the US grand design is nothing less than the transformation of the Middle East to bring it, as it were, into line with the impetus of the 89 movements and transformative forces. So a foothold in Iraq is a very vital step in that process. We know that wars are great, have intended and unintended consequences with respect to democratization. Many of the world's greatest democracies were instilled after war as a consequence of war. You think of the impact of, let's say, the Falkland War on the Argentine. So you take a foothold in Iraq. You withdraw forces from Saudi Arabia because that's a risk. Saudi Arabia, you want to stabilize. You want to stabilize Saudi Arabia to the extent possible so you can pull out forces and put them in Iraq. Isn't this grand design, as it were, nothing less than a traditional Cold War grand design in senses of modernization from above, a continuation of the project of modernization from above? Question.
Okay, I'll start with this last point. I think the fact that the Middle East has been untouched by 1989 is because it has already aligned itself with the victorious party long before that. If you look at what happened in the Soviet Union or the Eastern Bloc, that America has been for 40 years supporting democratization in the Eastern Bloc as a strategic policy. Radio Free Europe, asylum, huge resources were put into that endeavor. This coincided with internal developments to lead to what happened. In the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf markets have since 1945 aligned themselves with America, done what they were told. Iran did the same, but Iran fell victim to some other unexpected malaise. The Egypt moved back in the fold in 1970, 72, 73. So they have aligned themselves, and there have been the forces which are in action there, either nationalism or Islamic radicalism, are not to the liking of policymakers in the West. So there was no enthusiasm here for democratization there. People would say that, well, leave well alone. The fact that the Middle East is dangerous is, as I said, yes, you are right, precisely because of this kind of external weighing in support of forces which otherwise would not have been able to stay, to stabilize. Now, having a foothold in Iraq is, I think, as questionable as saying that quicksand is a base to stand on. I was always, as I said, I wrote once to say that I am part of the moral minority who supports the war on Iraq. But I don't see any reason from U.S. policy perspective why this war should be undertaken. Because this war was going to remove the regime of Saddam Hussein, which has been an impediment to Iranian influence in Iraq, to the Shia Iranian. You have a Shia Iranian, you have an Iranian Iraqi bloc, which will become the Gulf superpower, which will make the Gulf countries with no option but to do deals with these superpowers, regional superpowers. It will also, Syria will be an ally of this new regime. So democracy there is not going to bring pro-American, pro-Western forces to power. So other than explaining it in terms of divine providence, I can't see any rational explanation for it from this regard. So the problem here is, is the intervention going to support the forces of stabilization or destabilization in the region? I think as it stands now, is going to be destabilizing. Just as, for example, the presence of America in Saudi Arabia was destabilizing in the sense that it created instability for the Saudi regime itself and created threats for America, which didn't exist before. And actually, there was a problem of protecting. There was more effort and money supported in protecting the American soldiers in Saudi Arabia than the American forces were doing supporting, protecting anybody else. They are being protected from terrorist attacks from and move to the So there's a there is a, two ways of doing it. There is one way of trying to support the trends which are for stability, which are, you're right, the trends for democratization, but most probably, most importantly, for resolving the conflicts in the region, of which the Middle East conflict is a major one, but there are others. Because otherwise, if you have, as Yugoslavia has shown, having freedom and it does not entail stability, stability, unless you solve, you create the framework for this stability. Now, the issue which Harris mentioned about the fact that the Arab masses are very mistrustful of America and its motives is quite important in this regard. I think there is some irrationality in the way the masses mistrust America. And the funny thing, for example, is that the people who are concerned, for example, now, the Iraqi people, are very happy that the Americans have come in to liberate them. But every other Arab and Muslim outside Iraq is very unhappy and feeling violated, humiliated, invaded, powerless, angry, to an explosive degree. That, as we have seen, that there were volunteers who went there to fight, to discover, for example, that the Iraqis actually didn't want them to be there and fight. But this feeling is also dangerous, especially if you want, as we said, to promote democracy in this regard. If you have, if you promote democracy in this atmosphere, you will find really very angry and very violent views. Now, the conspiracy theories about America, I think, are part of the lore now in the region there. I don't, of course, think that there's any prospect for Israel to expand any more than it has expanded now. I mean, the challenge now is for Israel to contract, not to expand. And the question is by how much it should. But I think you are right that the belief is there, that this war has been there in order to. And I think some of the statements and rhetoric from American officials have led to this regard that, well, as I said, people have built this as the mother of all battles, which is going to shape the region and do force it to do the bidding. As I said, it's, these are dreams which are not going to happen, but they are, in the meantime, they create some destabilization. Regarding the exporting the American revolution and democracy, I think I welcome that if it was, if it would, if it was true. We would like to see the Middle East looking more like America in the sense of, not necessarily looking more like America in the sense of being Americanized, but in the sense of the officials being responsible to their subjects. Although, as I said, I am worried that America is now looking more than the Middle East, than the Middle East is looking like America. I mean, you. These days, you might be less at risk of imprisonment in Egypt than you are in America if you are an Arab or a Muslim. So that's a step backward in this regard. As I was coming here, the taxi driver who drove me was chatting to his to one of his mates about how things have gone bad in this country, and he said, When I got to the cap, he said to me, he was right. I said, what was it? He said, we are back now to the 19th century. I said, how? He said, well, inequality, draconian laws, lack of freedoms, things. And he gave me a lecture about Ricardo and Karl Marx. And I said to him, you are a very learned man. And he said, I am schooled in the limits of my ignorance. And I said to myself as I was walking here, how many Socrates are lost in the cabs of Central London. But anyway, I think the idea that there's a rolling back in freedoms here and America is a sign that the Middle East is infecting this side of the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. Now, did I China and the clash of civilization? I don't want to go much into that. I don't think there is any credibility to this, and I think there's also in the rhetoric of this argument is a contradiction, because, as I said, some of these theoreticians would say, well, the Middle East and China, these are countries which are oppressive, the regimes are oppressive. If only the people there were given their freedom, they will become friendly to us and democratic and everything. And then there's another argument, which is the other rhetoric, well, they don't deserve democracy, and they don't have it and they don't deserve it, and they are against us. So I think there's confusion in this, and it's not the place here to entangle it, to disentangle it.
Okay. All right, we're at this point we draw the proceedings. Okay. 30 seconds.
Your point, I think, about the governments supporting the U.S., I think, is not... I answered partly by speaking about the masses and how they felt. I think the governments in the region did not support the American war. I mean, they were reluctantly went along, but more of them did not want this war, and I don't think that they didn't want it for the reasons which I explained earlier, in that they, not for love of Saddam Hussein, but for fear of the forces that will release and the instability that will ensue, and the fact that it could set a precedent for democratization and also destabilization generally. So they were worried about themselves, and I think they have a right to be worried.
Okay, well, since I'm standing up, I thank you from the view from down there very much, and I wish everybody a good evening. Thank you.